as an old medic from Vietnam, I'm really motivated to try to save just a few more lives.
On Veterans Day, Alaska vets hope for VA improvements under a new administration. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November the 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans stand with protesters against an oil pipeline.
I feel like we're watching things happen that we're going to have to do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
University of Alaska students will see a 5% tuition hike next year. For Alaska residents, that means lower division classes for the 2017-2018 school year will cost $202 per credit hour at all campuses except Kodiak and the Prince William Sound College, which will be slightly cheaper. Upper division classes jump to $244 per credit hour, and graduate courses will ring in at $466 per credit. Non-resident tuition increases to more than $500 per credit. The Board of Regents approved the increase yesterday at its meeting in Fairbanks. It goes into effect starting with the fall 2017 semester. Donald Trump's election as president is expected to lead to major changes in the individual health insurance market. While states don't know what those changes will be, some policy experts suggested before the election that other states follow Alaska's lead in addressing rising prices. With the highest individual insurance cost in the country, Alaska is facing problems that other states may face soon. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on why other states may look to Alaska for answers.
Alaska enacted state-level reforms in response to premiums that nearly doubled in just 2 years. Now policymakers in some states, such as Minnesota, are trying to craft plans to address their own skyrocketing prices for health plans. Some are turning to Alaska as a model. A financial safety net program for health insurers is ending, and that's playing a major role in rising prices. The federal reinsurance program will no longer protect carriers hit with unexpectedly high costs for medical care. Many insurers have been surprised by high costs and big financial losses, so now they're raising premiums to cover worst-case scenarios.
I think that what we need is a reinsurance program at the federal level.
Washington and Lee University health law professor Timothy Jost wrote a blog post for the influential journal Health Affairs suggesting Alaska as a model.
States that are seeing particular problems with the insurers in their market should be looking at whether there's something they can do.
Alaska lawmakers enacted a state reinsurance program for next year when faced with a potential disaster. Moda, one of the state's two insurers, chose to leave the market. The remaining carrier, Primera, was planning to raise the highest rates in the nation by another 42%. Primera scaled that back to 7% after the reinsurance legislation passed. Lori Wing Heyer heads Alaska's Division of Insurance.
I think for those that were insured with Primera, that the reinsurance bill has been a welcome relief.
The plan called for devoting $55 million in taxpayer dollars to reinsurance. But lawmakers didn't embrace the idea entirely. Republicans who control Alaska's legislature raised concerns that the state was being stuck with costs caused by the Affordable Care Act. State Senator Peter Michicki says he's concerned the federal government is taking advantage of the state.
It's really fun to play poker with someone else's money. So when the feds are creating expectations and requirements under ACA and we volunteer to pick up the difference, we're really not ever pushing back on the feds to cover their unfunded mandate.
The administration of independent Governor Bill Walker argued that if the legislature didn't pass the bill, the result could be far worse. Alaska Deputy Commissioner Fred Parody made this case this way.
Our market is in crisis, and the consequence, if Premera were to withdraw, 23,000 Alaskans who are currently paying for insurance and receiving coverage would not have any access to insurance at all.
Parody argued the state would have to shell out hundreds of millions of dollars to establish a new insurance company if Premera left. The legislature ultimately agreed to the reinsurance program, but only for 2 years. What happens next is anyone's guess, but the state's reinsurance program is hardly a magic bullet. The program has headed off massive price hikes, but premiums here are already punishing for many and aren't going down. MOTA customers being forced to switch to Premera have to pay 30% more for insurance next year if they don't qualify for federal subsidies. But Alaska's innovation is making health insurance more affordable for at least one party, the federal government. Alaska officials estimate the reinsurance program will save the feds $20 million a year. In Anchorage, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
On this Veterans Day, the nation is transitioning to a new commander-in-chief who, for the first time in history, has no elected office or military experience. But that doesn't bother longtime veterans rights advocate Rick Davidge. Davidge started the Alaska Veterans Foundation in 2003. He is the head of the Vietnam Veterans of America chapter here and was the chair of the Alaska Veterans for Trump campaign. He says homelessness among veterans is one of the myriad problems that contributes to the more than 24 veteran suicides that happen every day in the nation. Davidge says many Alaska vets choose to live outside of urban areas in the wild.
I know them because they come in to Anchorage in the summertime. We often hire them to help with various projects, and they live here for 2 or 3 months camping out in the woods and make money, and then they use that money for the rest of the year. So Alaska has the highest per capita number of veterans. We have the highest per capita number of veteran suicides. So I'm, as an old medic from Vietnam, I'm really motivated to try to save just a few more lives.
Davidge says he believes Donald Trump will help clean up the VA by giving veterans the option of going to a VA facility or using VA benefits at other medical clinics and hospitals.
That would immediately reduce the waiting list, and it would give veterans a choice. There are a lot of veterans that want to use a traditional VA program, and that's fine. But there are a lot of veterans that don't, and I think that if veterans are given a choice over a 10-year period, we begin to find out which of those systems really works best.
Davidge just released his new book called The Second American Revolution, First 100 Days. He says the Trump campaign requested and received one of the first copies. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, video mapping Alaska's coastline.
It can be used for looking at climate change and how things are being affected along our coast. It can be used to look at fish habitat areas.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. From military might to counterculture cool to camo chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
A delegation of about 16 Indigenous women from across Alaska traveled to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota this week. The group brought gifts and resolutions from their communities to support the ongoing protest of the Dakota Access Pipeline Project. The Obama administration is set to issue a decision on whether to approve the pipeline route in the next few days. Amanda Frank has more.
Carrie Shaganoff traveled to Standing Rock on November 7th, carrying gifts and a resolution from the Chickaloon tribe. During a dinner of moose stew, salmon patties, and fry bread a few days later, Shaganoff and other members of the Alaska delegation presented a beaver fur hat and jars of salmon from Alaska to Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council Chairman Dave Archambault II. Chairman Archambault thanked the group for the dinner, gifts, and resolutions. He says his tribe has received a lot of support from other tribes across the nation.
I think the response was overwhelming. I'd say there's over, 350 tribes or organizations who wrote letters of support or who wrote passed resolutions by their nation's government.
About 16 Alaskans are camped at the Osheti-Shakowin camp, right next to where the proposed pipeline project is underway. The group is stationed in a part of the camp set up by the Indigenous People's Power Project, a nonviolent direct action support network of Indigenous trainers. The Alaska delegation has set up tents for others to use during the winter months and helped in the camp's kitchen, cleaning and preparing meals. Shaganoff, a member of the Chickaloon Tribal Council, shared her experience fighting a proposed coal mine across from the school in Chickaloon. She worries about having to take similar actions as the tribe in Standing Rock.
Everything that we've been seeing here, I feel like we're watching things happen that we're going to have to do.
Lisa Wade is from the village of Chickaloon. She spent election day at Standing Rock and was disappointed to hear the election results. She says she doesn't know what platform President-elect Trump has regarding Indigenous people.
For me personally, I was concerned about my home community and how they might be feeling today.
Wade plans to return to Alaska this weekend. She wants to take what she's learning here back to as many communities in Alaska to rally support for the people at Standing Rock.
Everybody has some way they can contribute to helping.
Faith Gemmel of Anchorage says the group is in Standing Rock to bring their love, blessings, and prayers to the camp. She says the majority of the delegation from Alaska are also from communities affected by resource development.
We live up there in the north, a traditional-based lifestyle that is based on the land and the waters. We hunt, we fish, we gather to survive.
The Alaska delegation presented a banner at the main protest camp that keeps a fire burning around the clock. The banner was decorated with handprints and various animals and food that many Alaskan communities rely on for nutrition and economic stability.
And you see our children's handprints? All of these little handprints are our children. They gave their handprints. That's why we're protecting our lands and fighting for our waters.
Most of the group will return home to Alaska this weekend. Gemmel plans to stay until next week to help another group from Alaska set up at the camp. In Standing Rock, I'm Amanda Frank.
As winter approaches, thousands of Alaskans are grappling with rising heating bills. And this year, for the first time in nearly a decade, the state won't step in to help. More than 9,000 households will see their heating assistance benefits reduced. Another 1,300 will likely be booted entirely from a now-defunct state program designed to keep low-income Alaskans warm. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has more on what happened to the program and who is most affected by the cuts.
In 2008, the state was in a different place.
Plenty of money in the coffers. The prices of oil were high. Home prices for home heating was very high, and they wanted to try to offset that.
That's Susan Marshall. She's the Heating Assistance Program Coordinator for the state. And she says the legislature created a heating assistance program to help low-income households cope with those high fuel prices. The program was a counterpart to the federal LIHEAP program. It helped cover people whose incomes were too high to qualify for LIHEAP. And the state's program was tied directly to the price of oil. Marshall says she would crunch the numbers.
So I would go back and look at the prices of a barrel of North Slope crude, take an average of what that price was.
When the price of oil was high, more money went into the program. The state also subsidized the federal heating assistance program so that the lowest income Alaskans got money from both to help with heating bills. But when oil prices crashed, so did the state's budget. The state cut the heating assistance program last year in an effort to trim spending. The federal LIHEAP program is still in place, but it only serves the lowest income Alaskans. And that means that more than 10,000 households in the state will see their benefits reduced or eliminated entirely this year. The heating assistance benefits are determined based on what type of fuel the household uses for heat, like wood, coal, or natural gas, and how big the home is. Priority goes to homes with older, disabled, or young family members, but it also depends on how cold the region gets. And while the largest numbers of people were cut in urban areas of the state, in rural areas, where it's more expensive to live and fuel prices are still high, the cuts are hitting especially hard. In Dillingham, temperatures have been dropping into the 20s and high teens at night.
So basically every day we have some kind of crisis application on the phone, which is typical this time of year.
That's Raybell Whitcomb. She's the director of the Workforce Development Center for the Bristol Bay Native Association. They serve 28 out of the 31 villages in their region with federal heating assistance. The program pays for everything from heating oil to wood, electric bills. By the second week of November, they've had more than 260 applications.
That's about a third of the more than 700 applications they'll get in Bristol Bay every year. And out of that, about 110 homes had incomes that are too high to qualify for the federal program. Whitcomb says they've helped people budget, encourage them to weatherize, turn down thermostats, and dress warmer in their homes.
What can and does happen sometimes is people will move in together, so there'll be more houses living together because they can't afford not to.
But Whitcomb says she's hearing from a lot of people who don't have the income to make up for the loss of heating assistance. And a big part of that was the cut to the PFD. Governor Bill Walker vetoed about half of the amount that was supposed to be paid out, and Alaskans got about $1,000 less than what was projected this year.
The double whammy of that was huge.
She says the cuts hit harder in rural Alaska because not many people have other sources of income.
You can't go down and get a McDonald's job for what it was, $9.75 an hour. There's not many of those other jobs.
Whitcomb says the recent warmer winters have made things easier, but she's worried this year will be much colder. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, with help from Elizabeth Jenkins, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Alaska has 33,904 miles of coastline, more than the rest of the United States combined. For a long time, there has not been much information available to researchers or to the public about that shoreline and about the wildlife habitats that exist there. KDLG's Avery Lill has more about a project that gives people the ability to research and explore the coast from their computers.
ShoreZone is a project that provides photo and video footage of the coast of Alaska. They passed a benchmark last month. Imagery of more than 90% of Alaska's coast is publicly available online. Sort of like Google Earth Street View, but for the coast. The project began in British Columbia in the 1970s. It came to Alaska in 2001. Kelly Ingram is the ShoreZone Partnership Coordinator for the Nature Conservancy.
You're able to fly and see images from the coastline and then see a ton of other data about the habitat, the substrate, the wave exposure, erosion potential, lots and lots of other data.
In order to map the shoreline, a team flies in a helicopter along the coast at low tide. They fly 300 feet off of the ground and 300 feet from the shore at 80 miles per hour. A photographer takes photos every 3 seconds, and another crew member takes video. There are a variety of uses for such imagery.
First off, it provides a baseline inventory of the coastline. This really provides really detailed information about the geology and the species that are there along our coastline so that it can be used for oil spill response planning, can be used for looking at climate change and how things are being affected along our coast. It can be used to look at fish habitat areas, or it can be used to plan your kayaking trip or, you know, if you're going out on your boat fishing or something like that.
The remaining 8% of Alaska's coast that ShoreZone has yet to map is going to be difficult terrain, Ingram says. But teams are at work on it right now. David Ward is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geologic Survey and the Alaska Science Center in Anchorage. He uses ShoreZone in his research in southwest Alaska. He maps the distribution and abundance of eelgrass in the Yukon Delta, Togiak, Eisenbeck, and Alaska Peninsula National Wildlife Refuges. Their primary means of mapping is by Landsat imagery and field surveys. And ShoreZone helps.
So it helped us to supplement some areas where we lacked insufficient data for mapping, or just further helped us to refine our mapping of eelgrass in those areas.
ShoreZone photographs, video footage, and data are free and available online at shorezone.org. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, massive healing. The Fairbanks 4's release from prison last year inspired Alaskan maestro Emerson Eads to compose a piece titled Mass for the Oppressed. Eads has lined up some impressive talent to perform the piece on Sunday in Indiana. And he's arranged for proceeds from sales of the production to go to an organization that represented the 4 Alaska Native men in court. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Emerson Eads says he was moved to compose Mass for the Oppressed to express both sorrows over injustices that led to the imprisonment of the Fairbanks Four and joy at their release last year.
As an Alaskan, as a Fairbanksan, what do I have to say to this conversation, and what do I have to say in response to these men, this injustice? And I felt like I had to respond musically.
That came naturally to Eads, a former conductor for the Fairbanks Symphony Chorus and Opera Fairbanks, who earned degrees in music at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and is now working on a doctorate at the University of Notre Dame. He says the Catholic-style Mass celebrates the grace the Fairbanks Four exhibited throughout their ordeal and afterward.
It was so moving to me. These guys had spent so much of their life behind bars, and yet, if you talk to them, what you get from them is not this hatred or anger, extreme anger. You get this sense of overwhelming thanksgiving that they are out and they can now experience the world.
Eads says he felt that generosity of spirit when George Fries, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent all thanked him after the world premiere of his Mass last summer at UAF's Davis Concert Hall, as did Fries's mother, Veronica.
I was a puddle of tears because I looked in her eyes and I could see that suffering, but I could see that like intensity and joy, and that she knew that her son would get out.
Activist April Monroe, who advocated for the Four and chronicled their story in her blog, says they appreciated the Mass and its message.
It was an interesting and a powerful experience that in some ways is difficult to articulate.
Eads says the piece celebrates universal themes that transcend culture, such as sacrifice and redemption. He says that's partly why he chose to tell the story in the form of a Mass, and partly because it reflects Pope Francis's declaration of 2016 as a year of mercy, which Eads recognizes by including text from Francis's diary in the piece's central movement.
Being here at Notre Dame and having the audience down here, I felt like a Catholic Mass or a setting of the Catholic text would be the right way to respond because of the universal nature of that text.
The Concordia Choir of Notre Dame will sing the Mass, accompanied by a full orchestra and some of the top names in American opera, all conducted by Eads. To help cover the production costs, Fairbanks artist and educator Carol Wilbur has launched an online fundraising drive.
I'm just so impressed with not only just the message of the Mass of the Oppressed, but also by the universal message that it carried.
Once the performance is produced, Eads plans to donate all leftover proceeds from the sale of CDs and downloads to the Alaska Innocence Project. That's the state branch of a nationwide organization that helps the wrongly imprisoned, like the Fairbanks Four, to get their day in court a second time. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Mass for the Oppressed will be performed this Sunday at Notre Dame University, Indiana. Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Ronald Coral in Anchorage. Coral is a UAA student and a second-generation Filipino-American.
My mom, she went to West High School her junior and senior year, and she also went to Diamond. And so she kind of got a pretty good view on what the American way was versus the Filipino way. And so she got a pretty good mix. My dad, on the other hand, definitely super Filipino, like fresh off the boat. And so like, you know, I think I had like a healthy balance between the two, is that, you know, she understood both, you know, how things are here versus how things are back home. And so she really instilled that with us, is that, you know, you, I mean, basically, you got to be well-rounded, you know. You can't be stuck one way or the other, but at the same time, don't forget where you came from. My parents, they own their own assisted living home, and they started that almost 20 years ago. And that was kind of their bread and butter. Because they've had that steady flow of income, they've been able to branch out and have different sources of income. The thing about my old neighborhood is that we had a very diverse neighborhood. And so I'd rather be outside than being stuck at home. And so, I mean, maybe that affected, you know, why I didn't learn the language or what. You know, at the time, I'd rather hang out with people my age and then and be a kid. I mean, just this melting pot kind of played a huge role. My parents speak it, but us kids, it just didn't click with us. A lot of Filipinos will relate to this, is that we're just very family oriented. It's not about us individually, it's about us collectively. I'm used to like dropping whatever I'm doing and helping out my parents or my grandma or my uncles or whatever, you know what I mean? Like that's just the way it is. And some people just don't get that. They want to be their own person. We're lucky up here. If Alaska can like transcend to the rest of the United States, like I feel like we'd be a lot better place.
Ronald Coral lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Tim Ellis and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Josh Edge and Andrew Kitchenman in Anchorage, Amanda Frank at Standing Rock, Rasha McChesney in Juneau, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.